Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Communist Poland had universal conscription, and the armed forces were huge by contemporary standards. The Polish People's Army, Navy and Air Force had just over 400,000 troops for most of the 1980s in a country of 36 million. Tom was a conscript in the Polish People's Army from 1987 to 1989. He served as a radio operator in Legnica for the rocket artillery. His service was at an interesting time when the communist dominance ended as Poland began to embrace democracy, with its first free elections since before World War II. Tom shares details of his conscription process, selection and initial training. We also hear of training exercises, attempts at political indoctrination, and his role if the Cold War had ever turned hot. I'm very keen to expand our library of Warsaw Pact voices, so if you know of any other English speakers who served in the Warsaw Pact forces during the Cold War, do let me know. The battle to preserve Cold War history is ongoing, and your support can provide me with the ammunition to continue to keep this podcast on the air. Via a simple monthly donation, you'll become one of our community and get a sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history.
Hello there, my name is Mark Franks, and I served in the Royal Air Force from 1982 through to 2007. What I find fascinating about Cold War Conversations are the stories and opinions of those that lived the other side of the Iron Curtain over that period.
Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If a monthly contribution is not your cup of tea, we also welcome one-off donations via coldwarconversations.com/donate. I'm delighted to welcome Tom to our Cold War Conversation.
You were 17 years old, and usually this process was organized together by your school and a local conscription office, let's say, which is military, you know, unit. So it was like one place, usually in a town, when from all schools, you know, all the 17 years old lads gathered together, and there were several, you know, desks with military, you know, people.
How was your role selected? I mean, how did they assign you to your role?
First, on the register, and I said in 70s years old when it happened, it was like interview as well, because they asking your hobbies, interests, and stuff, and where would you like to serve? So, I said, because I was already young radio amateur, my dad was electrician, qualified electrician, and radio engineer, and radio amateur. So we had like family tradition. And I thought, I would like to, if I have to serve, this is something I would enjoy. Because instead of going like, you know, infantry or artillery, it's not my really, I don't like it. So I said, if I'm going to spend some time in army, yeah, I didn't know if I get to uni. If I wouldn't get to uni, I would serve 2 years proper. So I thought, okay, so let's at least serve in the branch I really like, you know, that kind of my hobby, you know, corresponding. There were some questions. They were checking your medical records, and they used to give you, let's say, health category. because in Polish Army there were several health categories. You were just ready to serve or just not really capable of serving in the army. There were three categories. A, officially, army had to do like targets, you know, in conscription. So in the end, they didn't really take this in consideration. If you're A1 or A3, you were going to the same, to the service. So it was just one day experience. You know, you were in this, let's say, high school, college age, and when you were registered, and then you were excited because as a result of this, you were issued with army book, military service pass, as some countries name it. But anyway, it was little green, smaller of a passport, but green book. Then at a year of 18, next following year, those who were not in education anymore were conscripted. Myself, because I was still in education, I was aspiring to higher education, university. So you were like postponed for 1 year till you finish your secondary education. Once you finish your secondary education, there were like two ways. If I won't go to university, I would serve in army as a regular conscript. Or because I was about to go to uni, so there was 6 months service in the summertime in kind of cadet, like NCO for specialized soldiers. I mean specialized, you need like radio staff, some other, you know, branches of army which were very sophisticated because they were aiming for draft people who had some knowledge, some education. So I did this 6 months like school or something, and then you were allowed to go to uni. In a uni you had like every week few hours of class where you going, and then you were like shooting, and we would never consider ourselves as a regular army because we always were students. You regular army used to call us peasants, you know, like birds, with, you know, because we were our students. They not really a professional army, but to be honest, we did loads of calculations, operating these computers, early computers, you know, army or something. So, but they will never consider us as a student, as a, how to say, mincemeat for the front line.
Yeah, what we'd call cannon fodder.
Yes, exactly. It was just like kind of living in between two worlds, regular, proper, you know, conscript army, which were harsh conditions, loads of trainings, drills, and then we had more slack terms, easier terms, not such disciplined, because it just like, oh, we were serving, it was mandatory serving anyway, but oh, they never gonna be a serious army, they reading books, you know, they softies. But on the other hand, we had loads of jobs within, you know, when there was like field training, polygon, we used to call it. When you're going to the field train, you know, with regulars, we had lots of very important jobs to do. Like, you know, some, I remember some guys doing coordinates from, they were students of maths or something, physics, but they have to coordinate with rocket artillery proper, you know, and stuff on these army computers. I was in radio comms. At some point, they were really dependent on us, but we didn't get lots of, let's say, bollocking or harsh terms from regular NCOs, let's say, like proper corporal, you know, standing on other troops, because they were never considered as army material, let's say, this way.
Yeah, you were never intended to be in the front line. You were supposed to be working the technology and some distance behind the lines, I guess.
Yeah. And I think the most bizarre was when we, on year two, we met because, you know, instead of like you have in uni, summer break, on year two, I've met guys from medical uni, future doctors. And they were completely lost there. There was a different world for them, but they were serving as medical staff, but not senior. And they were completely lost with discipline, with this routine, just completely unused to it. But they were the most cherished, actually, part of the within field camp, because they could prescribe funny tablets, or they could organize a pure spirit from the laboratory. So they were most cherished guys, you know, because they had power of making it easier to for these harsh conditions.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more. From what you were saying there, it sounded like with university that you had some form of military classes when you were at uni.
Yes, but it was like stamp on this intellectual class. You need to know your place within this ruling workforce class. I don't know, you know, it's typical communist system when all intelligentsia has to know its place, a kind of boot stamp on your, you know, aspiration, that in the end you not the, you know, your aspiration doesn't matter. It's what matters is our joint effort and standing against NATO and you know, capitalism and stuff, instead of going on lecture about sociology or philosophy. You had as well 1 hour and a half a week to 3 hours lecture, and lecture was about politics, about socialism, and about how it's better. It was part of military, you know, service, but in reality it was political stuff. We didn't learn much about military. We did learn about politics, why West is so evil, why we should stand together, and all this, I would say, bollocks. No one believed this, you know. We were, you know, laughing, well, not openly, but, you know, everyone just looks, and, you know, I think no one took it seriously. But I think it was the time, the most, I would call it, waste of my life. The most, and everyone knew, everyone had the same feeling. It was absolutely a waste of time. But good thing was when we had a lecturer who didn't believe the same. He was what we was, you know, so he was on the same side like we are. So at least it was gone quick. And but few, on many occasions, unfortunately, we had some believer, let's say. These people were like opportunist or to show you power, you know. For them, from beginning, you know, in these lectures, we were like let know that we are nothing to them, we just students. So we were this useless class intelligentsia, you know, I mean, in the terms of social classes, we are intelligentsia, so we are useless.
Where did you receive your military radio training?
I was granted to go to this NCO school not far from my where I live. which was 10 miles away only. And it was only two in Poland, another one in the other side. Usually you get ticket to army and you go to the other part of Poland, you know, because there was tactics, you know, to break connection with families. So they said, okay, close enough, you could go there.
You mentioned earlier that NATO was still considered the enemy. So was the training with a view to offensive actions, or was your training purely defensive at this point?
Regular military training, when you have shooting and drill, you know, on a field, it was more defensive. But then sudden change when you had classroom with radio comms. Then it came really like encryption, your communication, and structure, how you communicate. And it was offensive, really. It was orientated towards West. I mean, there were concentration of units, military units, tank groups, and armored, you know, infantry regiments along the West border, ready to go to East Germany. I think it was like second wave or something. And we knew that it's going to be like a second wave about structure and discipline of communication, how, you know, to communicate. So two things. Basic military training was officially defensive in case of nuke strikes. But your professional training, when you know, on your job, what you're supposed to do, was rather offensive one. Actually, we were told we were on the second line of defense or offense.
Because I think some of the Polish forces were earmarked for Denmark.
I live in Silesia, you know, southwest. So we were actually marked for Thuringia, Hessen, this area, you know. If we were find ourselves, you know, serving in this armored infantry units or tanks units from southwest Poland, we would go as a relief forces for Russian units stationed already in Saxony, who were already in moving to the Thuringia, Hessen, or Bayern, you know, this area. Like on second wave in following.
Were you given much weapons training at all? Was your training very different to what a fighting soldier would have, or was there some weapons training?
Basic mandatory was AK-47, but well, it wasn't 47. It was because they were new at the time. Well, we recognize this new AK-74, AKM or AKMS, can't remember. There was folding stock, this 5.45 millimeter. They were quite fresh in army because they were quite small, smaller than, you know, regular one. So we were issued the first, and we were, you know, learned to shoot, which is just on the beginning, 2 days, really, and then shooting range. And shooting range was awful because kick was quite strong and not everyone used to, you know, so we had all this, you know, shoulders quite bruised. And aiming or something, it was badly, really, on this. Sorry if I call it wrong, but it was a short one version of AK-74 version. Then, pistols. It was P-64, which was really, you could just shoot from 10 meters, you know, away, and you had 50-50 chance you hit target of, I don't know, Titanic. They were so inaccurate, you wouldn't believe. Bad weapon. But because of our job's role, we're supposed to have the short weapons, not long one. I mean, not proper one. throwing grenades, obviously, training, you know, and pretty, yeah, and anti, let's say, gas or radiation, this rubber-like suit jumps. I mean, they were really awful, and because we had to do some even distance, you know, running in this, people were really nearly suffocated, and this was the worst training, as I remember, when you had to just run some distance with already smoke screen and this tear gas, just to make you impression that you have to cover this field and on time and dressing off this suit. And I'm not talking only about gas mask, it was full, you know, cover shield. So it was one of the worst I remember. But basically, we had mandatory on short weapons. I mean, arm fire, arms, and just grenades. No, we didn't get any other more sophisticated, like infantry stuff.
So your role, would you have been mobile in an armored personnel carrier or something?
On most occasions, I was in, like, BMP, one of the BMP converted to the com stuff, loads of communication stuff. But on two occasions, on other year, I was in proper one. It was like truck with like armored protection, you know, inside, like regular truck looks like, you know, but on the back, instead of flatbed, you have built up this armored, you know, chamber with full loaded with communication stuff. And it used to tow trailer with another one like chamber, or there were different trailers. One trailer had, you know, communication because, let's say, short waves, ultra short waves on different frequencies, but as well trailers had antenna systems, so our truck used to tow antenna system behind for the communication, you know, we unfolding and setting them up inside, loads of radio station on different working on different levels, plus some encryption stuff. It was modern, it was quite new, and that was really a big deal. I think it was new in the army, you know, just like early computers.
How was the encryption done? Did you say it was done via computer technology, or did you have code books as well?
There were code books, but because I was on radio op on shortwave, ultra shortwaves, and I wasn't team of the encryption, so I don't know exactly process, because we were separate. We were not supposed to know. But I gather, because I saw what's there and how they're working, it was still analog process in encrypting, but computers were like to shorting process, do calculations, some calculations for them. I was receiving messages encrypted, and I had to record them and pass to the encryption team. And vice versa.
And were there still political officers in the Polish army at this
point? Oh, yes, yes. So every company had one on company level. I can't remember if it was on platoon level even. No, I don't think so. But company level, yes, we had the political officer, the old ones. And they were, yeah, as I said, opportunists, believe it. And they, I didn't like them because they couldn't cope with changes in the world. You know, late 80s, it was started with globalization and stuff. And they felt like really frightened by the West. You could see with them, they couldn't cope with reality. So I'm glad they didn't have any influence of this red button, you know, to start the war, because it was just like they've noticed changes in society, how things progress, but they couldn't really accept this. They were like, we're going to show them, you know, in the end, we're going to show them. I mean, we're going to show West, you know, superiority or whatever. So, and there were young chaps, typical opportunists, you know, sometimes fresh after military school, they were trying to fraternize with us, to talk easy talks, organizing even, you know, vodka, alcohol. Oh, guys, we're going to organize. I'm going to organize. I have this connections with, you know, Star and with logistic. But I bet that all of them, they were as well secret police agents. In Poland, we had the category tajny współpracownik, which means secret cooperator with secret police.
So a collaborator, an informer.
Informer, yes. The secret informer. Oh, that's the best description. So, and I bet every political officer had to sign this contract for being as well a secret informer. So, and we knew this. Well, most of us knew it. We didn't want really to, you know, banter with them because you just slip your tongue or something and you didn't know what consequences could be. And I was still not my uni was not still finished. I wasn't graduate yet. So it could affect my, you know, process of graduating. So no one want to, you know, risk career. So yeah, they were political officers, but they had good influence of regular conscripts from those guys, young guys, 18 years old, who just finished basic education with like some, you know, educations. So they were just like role models, let's say. In my team, we all were, let's say, newly graduates. So have some background, some education, some knowledge. And to be honest, all of us, like single one, we despise this system. And we're anti-army, to be honest. We had to, because we were serving because we had to, but everyone, as I remember, would just like drop the uniform instantly as, you know, the gates close, you know, barrack gates close behind you. It's nothing to do with patriotism. It's about when you're serving oppressive system, you try to just strip yourself of this, all these ranks and uniform. For that reason, I have no pictures from my time in uniform when I was wearing uniform. But I really didn't like it. Because you were part of the system, you really didn't like it. For people, I think in the West, it's very difficult to understand because serving in the army is quite patriotic. You dedicate yourself for your country. But in time, what I was doing, it was quite opposite. You are doing your time in the army being against your fellow, you know, citizens, fellow people. Because army was one of the way to oppress country.
Were you ever worried that you would be ordered to, I don't know, stop a demonstration or something like that?
Not at the moment when I was serving. It's reason why, because already police, militia, obywatelska, developed quite strong forces to oppress all this civil undress. Beginning of the 80s, they had no such big forces, I mean, in terms of numbers. ZOMO, which was special police military.
It's like a paramilitary unit within the police, the ZOMO, yeah.
Yes. And they were quite in the 80s when Solidarity broke out. They were not big enough to suppress, you know. They were just fresh. So on that occasion, quite a lot, quite authorities were used army for this job. But since Jaruzelski introduced this curfew on 1981, this Zomo forces were really expanding quite a big. So when I was serving in 87, 88, Zomo was so big they could cope themselves with any, let's say, unrest, any protest. So army was like standing away, you know. Even army generals didn't want to get involved anymore with political, you know, movement. They pretend that army is not politically involved in the Polish affairs. It's neutral. It wasn't true because on every level we had this politruks, I mean political officers. We were still, you know, learning how to cope with NATO strike or how to counter strike to NATO. We still about leading, were taught and reminded about leading way of Communist Party, PZPR. So, in fact, they were not neutral, but they pretend for the society that they are neutral.
Were you in many exercises? I mean, obviously, you would have been practicing all the time, but as far as a big, maybe Warsaw Pact exercise, did you ever participate in anything like that?
I think I missed one. It was 1988. We had field days. Well, I had nearly two months in the eastern border, you know, other side of the country, near Soviet Union border, damn time, Brest, Terespol. So I could tell you that all this, how to say, feeling, how you were doing this field exercises was completely different. It was, you had this impression that Big Brother looks at you. And officers, NCOs, they were act completely different. We had more serious. When we were doing in our region, you know, field exercises, it was like easygoing. Okay, we had some field walks and then setting up comms stations, you know, masking and encryption. It wasn't set time. We had in our time and distances were not so big, well, I thought. But then following year, my last year, just before I was, we went to this, you know, east part. Really, we had like 2 kilometers to Soviet Union border, and we could see Soviet, you know, I think border soldiers or something, or patrolling border. So it was so close. And instantly on the first night, 20-mile walk with full equipment on the back, which when we were not used to, but because no one was so crazy when, you know, last year or so, you know, in our, but now suddenly took it all serious. Second night, again, 20 miles plus set up camp and completely camouflage and hidden, you know, some relay point. I mean, relay, communication relay. And third night was, again, somewhere in the fields, in a just boggy terrain, marshy, boggy terrain, I think to intercept some communication we were setting up against stage. So it was, suddenly it was serious, you know, with all seriousness taken. And our NCOs didn't want to, you know, they were like, suddenly change approach, everything, you know, they try to make some impression of leading. There were different leading officers, so that's one of the reasons. But we had like, I think there were Russians as well, observers on this exercise, so maybe that's the reason why we had to, you know, suddenly do everything proper, serious way.
everything by the book.
Yes, yes. But you see, it's 1988, and we had Russian, you know, Soviet observers within army. You know, how we're doing. And they had, you know, final word.
Did you work with any of the other Warsaw Pact countries, or was it just really the Russians that you had dealings with?
Oh, we dealt with quite a lot with Russians in where there was our NCO school, radio com school, Legnica, because Legnica was headquarters of Russian Group Army North, as I remember, and there were plenty of Russians, and they have as well a radio com school there, or a unit. So on many occasions, we actually ended up on the field, not together, but some exchange parts. Our, let's say, barracks or garrison, where the school was next door to Russian one. It was just literally a wall, brick wall. You know, behind the brick wall was Russian part. So in sometimes with these chaps, I think it was unit who were serving. There was Russian airfield as well. So they were serving on the airfield communication. So because the equipment was very similar in long range, especially long range was quite, you know, same. So if we're lacking of any parts or something, we used to go there asking them if they have any, you know, for servicing. And I remember going, you know, to Russian next door garrison, asking for some, let's say, Vanya or whatever, you know, Russian name, because he knows he has this logistic, you know, in some storage, he has these tubes, we eat one, and on a piece of paper, he just write them off or something, you know, and we got them. But it was first few phone calls, you know, to organize this. Our, you know, leading master of school, I mean, there was like, in terms of teacher, you know, but he was NCO, so he used to organize. Oh, guys, I just spoke with the Russian. You go there on particular time because it was on a gate. You have to be on particular time. When I'm talking about this, I think it was quite kind of stealing from Russian, you know, storage, you know, because he was writing off the Russian bloke who was responsible. He was writing off tubes. I remember tubes especially, as broken or whatever. And then a particular time, let's say 5:15, at this time, at this gate, we're going to, you know, do a deal. So he was handing over us these tubes. They always request something else. And we used to bring, and you know, fitting tubes, then tuning stuff, working. Our, you know, commandant was happy like hell because we are, oh, another two pieces of equipment now working, and you know, he can just put in the report that, you know, we successfully, you know, repair this.
Were you ever instructed what to do if you were captured by NATO forces? What information you could give them?
No, we didn't have any training about this, but there was from political officer on the beginning when we were talking about this chain command, you know, when we movement towards west, and because it was more like being how we're gonna be allocated in the future in case of war broke out and what's gonna happen, and it was like 15 minutes about what it could be if we were captured, and we were talking only about rank and service number. That's all. And obviously damage stuff before it falls in hands of not an enemy.
So destroy your code books and damage the equipment so it can't be used.
Damage equipment, yes, and specifically we had the specifics, because some people don't realize that there are very easy way to completely make this use equipment. You don't need to burn everything. You don't need to, you know, explode everything. Just there are particular parts, especially with radios, that you can just take it away or something, and it's rendering completely useless. So we knew, you know, we were on each part of equipment as well. We were trained how to make it completely rendered without much effort, or, you know, without using grenade, but your brain, that way.
You mentioned Legnica before, the big Russian garrison town, and this was right next to your base as well. The Soviet base was right next to your base, was it?
Legnica, from my point of view, was very specific and important when we're talking about this town. First, my family and I lived, and I was born just 10 miles away from Legnica. Legnica is a was big town, city, today size of 200,000 citizens, you know, living there. So it's quite big. And at that time was the same amount. But specifics of Legnica was in 1945, just after Second World War finished, Soviets decide to set up there in Legnica one of the command center of the Russian occupying forces for Germany and for Poland. So it became headquarters for Soviet forces for Poland. They used to call it Army Group North, I think. Germany was Army Group West. So yeah, we had Army Group North, and it was proper headquarters with all center of communication, of logistic for all Soviet forces in Poland. And on the top, there were loads of high-ranking staff, Soviets, living in Legnica with their families. And they decide to, like in Berlin, they divide Legnica in half. Former German town was divided in half, and with wall as well, like in Germany. And behind the wall, Legnica is like smaller Berlin, you know, copy of Berlin of a time, because the Russian quarter was surrounded by the wall, and there was living quarters. They were about, some historians even today estimated it was nearly 100,000 people, you know, Russians living there behind the wall, military and civilian staff. And other half of the town was Polish, but with Polish, let's say Polish part, there was like one third as well military garrison, which including there were some hospital, there was especially communication radio forces, which I was serving. So I could, you know, and our part of barracks was like next door to the Russian. But I still remember these walls, you know, across the town with gates, with checkpoints, Russian checkpoints, which was literally like you see in Berlin. And there was lots of Polish people who lived in Legnica, but who were working in the Russian quarter. But they had to carry with them a special pass. They were always on a checkpoint search, you know, to pass through for their work and back. So it was a really important, you know, place, even on when you have railway station in Legnica. It was only one, and it was in Polish part, but there were special platform only for Russian, for Soviets. And you cannot go on this platform unless you are a Soviet soldier with a special pass or something. It was. And from that platform, there was running twice a day direct trains to Moscow. So well, I used to travel, you know, because my mom worked in sometime in, like, you know, for some sort of period of time. I was like, you know, to my military, well, NCO school, so in the train as well from my town, Javor. And we just, you know, train just stopped on the platform, and next platform was the Russian, and the train to Moscow was ready, all boarding with lots of Russians, and, I mean, yeah, Russians and militarist Soviets, you know, boarding on.
As you're getting into 1989, how is the army changing with, for example, the electoral success of Solidarity? Does that have any impact on the way you see the army changing at that point?
I would say discipline within army falls much lower. I mean, slack, I mean, relax. It's not, relax is very wrong way to describe, but lack of discipline in a lower, especially levels. On the high ranks, you could see this waiting for the outcome, what's going to happen, how it's going to happen. It was more like waiting a game. But army hasn't changed on this conscript level for next, let's say, few years. It's a part of political stuff. So political officers and all this stuff disappeared soon after. But way of treating conscripts, trainings, everything was carried on for next, I think, 2 or 3 years. So army in general hasn't changed for next few years, good few years.
And still with a view that the West is a threat?
No. This very quickly disappeared. Reason why no one believed even in late 80s. You know, it was like talking about when we had this political lectures, everyone, you know, just could laugh, really. No one believed this thing. We did understand that if war broke out, we might end up in Germany as a second wave. But that was quite real. But in terms of that NATO is a threat in this, so 89, 90, this is gone. There was no any offensive. Army become more like defensive one.
I guess the worry was that the Russians wouldn't leave or would come back.
Yeah. Till they leave Poland, army was like, carry on. Without this edge, without this, you know, anti-NATO propaganda. But they were carrying on the same system, the same trainings, the same military structure. Till we had Soviet in Poland. And when they withdrew in 92, then I think some kind of reforms has started on many levels. But till then, till they literally withdrew, army, I remember army hasn't changed, because I left 89. I had friends who were in 91 or 92. And when we spoke, and we just like the same, we're talking about the same story, a part of this political bullshit. I used to, you know, hear nothing, you know, the same, some silly trainings, which we already knew they were used, pointless. They still were carried on, and all this.
When you look back at your career in the Polish People's Army, how do you view that now?
Hard to say career.
I'm joking. Really... That was a bit tongue-in-cheek.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, but you see, from one hand, from the, you know, I really, I didn't like this term. What I, you know, time, and but as well, I appreciate and I found lots of laughs when I remember that how bad army we were. Yeah. You know, how useless army were. It just like makes you really laugh, smiling, and then then you just think, no, it wasn't bad. It was quite fun because we did loads of stuff you're supposed to not, you know, in terms of discipline. We were absolutely appalling. You wouldn't do in professional army whatsoever. But we had to serve. So this, if you have 6 months to serve, you're trying to find how the easiest way is to spend this time, you know, not conflicting. Somehow it reminds me the Czech novel of Schweik.
The Good Soldier Schweik.
Yeah. We were kind of this. We were that kind of army, really.
Yeah. So you were almost like pretending to do the job.
Oh yeah.
But not really doing it. Look, make yourself look busy.
Yes, definitely. We did. We did pretend, especially when we had. I can't remember R108 or something radio station, which was like backpack, you know, you could have it. It's ultra short wave radio station, analog, no encryption or something. It was close communication on the battlefield, really, stuff on short range, and we had to pretend, especially in the summertime on exercise, 3 times, I think. They were bulky, they were heavy, not really nice to carry on. And so we used to, teams between each other, we used to agree what sort of reports we're going to send each other on a, you know, piece of paper. And then instead of carrying the massive batteries, you know, in them, in this radio station, so like you have, let's say, tourist backpack on your back and half loaded with proper batteries, you know, car batteries. So like for, it was heavy. So instead of these batteries, we used to have alcohol, you know, bottles of alcohol or beer, and just only one set to keep working in case some, you know, gonna call us or something. But then in a field, we have already reports, you know, agreed. So we put in the books what we did, and then next few hours, enjoy your sun, you know, summertime. That kind of army.
Don't miss the episode extras, such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. If you'd like to help the project, just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.